You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
To the rich man's bright lodges, I ride in this wind. On my good horse, I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
Lies told to initiate the invasion of two countries, resulting in the deaths and maiming of millions of people. The use of the Department of Justice to target political opponents, the creation of enemies lists and mass surveillance of our electronic communications under the rubric of terrorism prevention, the shoveling of billions of dollars into no-bid, war-related contracts for corporate cronies, the kidnapping, indefinite detention, and torture of people, and the attribution of monarchical powers to the presidency. These are the hallmarks of a fascist takeover of the United States. None of this would have been possible without the Enabling Act, the events of September 11th, 2001, the truth of which has not yet come out. This week, we're going to hear updates from two of the 9/11 Truth Movement's top researchers, author Dr. David Ray Griffin and architect Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truths. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. To set the context for 9/11 as an American Reichstag fire, we'll begin the show with addressing the question of fascism in America with Larry Britt, author of a 2003 article on the 14 characteristics of fascism. His talk, It Can't Happen Here, or Can It? Larry Britt is a former businessman who has been an active commentator on political and economic affairs for more than 18 years, and is a contributing author to half a dozen books, including his most recent, A Chapter on Fascism for Political Power and the Global Economy, published last year. He spoke in Rochester, New York, on February 16th.
I'd have to say right from the outset, many people would find what I'm about to say as very controversial or un-American. And there may be people here who think that way. So let's just go through it and see what we all have to say. The title of the discussion tonight, It Can't Happen Here, or Can It? And, of course, what is this big it that we're talking about? Fascism is what it is. Of course, that title came from Sinclair Lewis's book of 1935, which talked about fascism in America. So, what is this it that we're talking about? Dictionaries try to define it. Many people have a different view as to what this it actually is. I've even heard it called recently that what we're really fighting is not terrorism, but Islamofascism, which is a rather curious term, especially when you look at the definition that is generally viewed as about it. This comes from the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language. And fascism, a philosophy or system of dictatorial government of the extreme right, typically through the merger of state and corporate leadership, usually tied to an ideology of belligerent nationalism. But again, it's a term that is used and abused, but this is what the general description of it is. Many people will say that this is not an issue for the United States. We have a constitution that has been in place for now for 225 20 years, and it seems to work. We just had an election in which a different political perspective hopefully has come into office, and therefore the risk of fascism has passed, even if it ever actually existed here in the U.S. Back in the fall of 2001, shortly after 9/11, I was shocked, just like everybody else was. And we certainly looked to the conditions in the country and tried to come to grips as to what it was all about. And, of course, we saw a significant increase in Americanism, if you want to call it. Flags were out there all the time. Even jingoism was in the air. We had the Patriot Act. We had the statements such as, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. So it was a little bit of a scary time. In fact, it was a lot of a scary time. I looked at these events and thought about it and began to collect information about historical fascism and how it related to what I saw was happening in the country. And so I began to do some research, and I put together an article, and I basically identified 14 points that were characteristic of fascist regimes. And I submitted that to Free Inquiry magazine, and they published it in April of 2003. And there was a kind of a astonishing response to it. Before I knew what had happened, it was all throughout the internet, and there were hundreds of thousands of hits, and it was and it went to Europe. It was put into French and Italian and German, and it was talked about on the radio. I was asked to be on radio talk shows. I would be riding on the street and hear on the radio from Air America, and I would be quoted, and I was like, oh, where did all this come from? So obviously, what I wrote struck a responsive chord. And clearly what was going on in the United States under Bush was concerning to an awful lot of people, and that's why this had this kind of a reaction. So what are the characteristics that I identified? And again, this was from regimes that went from Italy to Germany, to Spain, Chile, Greece, Indonesia, countries that had fascist type of governments either before World War II or after. Some of the characteristics that we're seeing: powerful displays of nationalism, disdain for human rights, identification of enemies as a unifying cause, and that was typically to point out to the people what it is that they had to hate or fear or direct their anger towards. Supremacy of the military, sexism, which included homophobia, a controlled media, obsession with national security, religion and government intertwined, corporate power protected, power of labor contained. In fact, even a general disdain for the poor, disdain for intellectuals in the arts, rampant cronyism and corruption, fraudulent elections. So these were the items common in fascist regimes. I'm not going to go into each one of them in detail and explain what it was that occurred in those regimes. If you'd like to see that, I would recommend that you take a look on the internet under my name, and it'll go right to all those items in detail. Other internet blogs picked up on it, and one in particular, the Project for the Old American Century, went through each of those items and pointed out what was happening in the U.S. to prove that those things perhaps were also happening in the United States. One of the first things that we saw after 9/11 was the fact that most countries came right behind the U.S. and supported us based on the trauma that we had been through. Unfortunately, that quickly disappeared, which certainly is an area of great concern. The Pew Research did a survey in June of 2006, which compared the attitudes towards the U.S. in five countries in Europe, which was actually England, France, Italy, Spain, and Germany. And it showed the percentage of people in 2000 who viewed the U.S. favorably, which was 71%, versus the amount of people who viewed the U.S. favorably in 2006, which had dropped down to 39%. And seven countries in the Middle East, 48% viewed us favorably in 2000, and only 18% held that favorable view in 2006. And the interesting thing is all of those countries viewed China more favorably than the U.S. Some would say, so what? We have to do what we have to do regardless of the opinions of the outside world. This, I think, is a very short-sighted point of view. And if we're going to try to get anything accomplished in the world, it's going to be pretty tough to do if we don't have any allies. Part of that research by the Pew Global Research poll wanted to see what respondents thought of the characteristics of various kinds of governments, communists, governments, socialists, and they even had one for neo-fascists. And they identified things that would characterize that kind of a government. And they were arrogance, aggressiveness, human rights abuses, and disdain for international law. Of course, we have to think of what the view of the U.S. Would be during those years that this survey was held, and whether they fit the fascist mold. One question was, what exactly is it that's been happening in the U.S. that would characterize the prior 8 years before the last election? And, of course, we've all heard about the neocons, neoconservatives. And this was a philosophy that was espoused by a gentleman by the name of Leo Strauss. And the position that he espoused, which was taken over by many who became part of the last presidential administration of Bush, subscribed to this philosophy. This can be described: neoconservatism departs from the traditional conservatism in that it proposes a dominant international posture, the ascendance of a political elite, the distrust of the common citizens' ability to understand the need for geopolitical decisions. His philosophy stressed the use of religion and nationalism to secure the allegiance of the masses to the will of the state. and the aggressive use of political power in foreign affairs and the exercise of dominant military force in support of economic interests and national security. The organization that picked up on this primarily was a thing called the Project for the New American Century, PNAC. And PNAC was founded by William Crystal and James Kagan. And many people who were in the Bush administration were part of that particular organization, which included Cheney, Libby, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Bolton, Abrams, and Pearl. So the neocons were certainly in ascendance during this period. The other concept is neoliberalism, which is not a common term used here in the U.S. because what we call it is laissez-faire capitalism. But in the rest of the world, it's called neoliberalism. Basically, what that says is that power and profit should go to the economic elite, and everyone else basically was on their own. To the neoliberal, acquisition of money and power were the natural outcomes of economic activities and should be accepted as such. The have-nots deserve their fate and should not be trusted with political power. And therefore, their votes were not important and could be suppressed. And we actually have seen that in this country. Back in 1941, psychoanalyst Eric Fromm, who lived in an era where the fascist model was in ascendance around the world, tried to comprehend exactly why it was that it was successful, because intuitively it shouldn't be. Because if you look at the neocon, neoliberal model, it doesn't offer much for the common individual. So the question was, how could the average person be brought along to accept this kind of a philosophy? He definitely had some ideas backed up by the research which he did. First of all, the whole concept of freedom and what it is, because the theory that he had was the escape from freedom, which was why people were willing to give it up, you know, for something else. As a matter of fact, freedom is a term that is really hard for most people to comprehend. When people on the streets in the U.S. are asked why are we in Iraq, they will say something like fighting for our freedom, which again is a concept that's really hard to understand in that context, because how can Iraq, as to whether or not we've been in there, could have any impact whatsoever, you know, on American freedom is a question you just have to contemplate. So Fromm asks, what is freedom in the human experience? Is the desire for freedom something inherent in human nature? And if so, what are the social and economic factors in society that define it? Can freedom become a burden too heavy to bear from which we have to escape? And why is freedom for ourselves a cherished goal, but for others is a threat? The research that he did basically said that fascism thrives in a society and it's built on the attitudes that come from what we could call the lower middle class. This is a social class that has been recognized as the most insecure, angry, and disaffected in modern society. Now, the power elite and the nationalists and the military, of course, and those with lots of money, they're in a different group. But they, by themselves, could never achieve power. they need the support of this grouping that he classifies as the lower middle class. And he described it. Their outlook on life is narrow. The authority of religion and traditional morality firmly rooted. They suspect and hated the stranger, the foreigner, and the nonconformist. And they admired the strong and hated the weak. They were willing to submit to authority, but this loss of autonomy was compensated for by the self-pride and power in those being submitted to. What is the actual history here of fascism and where it took place? Italy, where it all began back in the early 20s. And the symbol was the axe and rods, which is like an axe going up, and there's rods, you know, all around it. And it was called the fasces, which was the symbol of power of ancient Rome. So even from its inception, it was a symbol of power, military might. And in this particular case, it was aimed against the left and the communists, who in the early 20s was viewed as a threat all over Europe. So this was going to be the counter to that threat. And it was an amalgamation of conservative forces, business leaders, monarchists, the military, and the church. As a matter of fact, Mussolini was behind the establishment of the Vatican as an independent country within Italy to once again solidify traditional forces, including the church. Of course, Italy's experience, you know, with fascism was horrible. As a matter of fact, every fascist regime ends up in a terrible state, defeated, country in shambles, you know, one way or the other. And Italy in particular, the Italian people, even though they were taken over by this concept, never really accepted it. It just didn't fit, you know, with their mentality in any way. Germany was a different story, though. And of course, Germany is the quintessential fascist state. The Weimar Constitution, which was put in place in Germany right after World War I, was designed to some degree after the U.S. It was a very liberal constitution. The Nazi Party, formed in the early 20s, was designed and built on hate, fear, and anger. Those were the things that attracted people to follow it because of all the issues that existed in Germany at that time. The National Socialist German Workers' Party. Of course, it was not socialist in any way. In fact, there was a different party in Germany that was socialist. Many people on the right actually put the claim in that Nazism was a movement of the left, which is, of course, completely preposterous, but nevertheless, it's often heard. Well, you heard it was National Socialist. It achieved power because of the traumatic event of the Great Depression. Up until 1929, its following was quite small. But once issues bubbled up and an alternative came along that said that it would take care of the problems, brought them into power. Now, I want to spend a little time talking about the Enabling Act. Hitler was appointed chancellor in a coalition. Other forces in Germany felt that he could be controlled and that this was only a temporary situation that would pass. The Reichstag burned. It's a big traumatic event. And it was believed that something had to be done to address the issues that were coming to the fore. And basically, Hitler said that he was going to act for the protection of the German people. And therefore, this act was passed, which was supposed to be a temporary act. The basic aspects of this was to eliminate the protections of privacy of the mail, the telephone, telegraph, search and seizure, and the suspension of habeas corpus. Now, I'm sure you've all heard these things in the last few years here in the United States. And we, of course, said, well, these were things we had to do because of the danger that faced the country. Now, the Enabling Act was passed in 1933, was renewed again in 1936, was renewed again in 1939, renewed again in 1942. So it was just a question of keeping to renewing it time after time, which really meant that there was a collapse of constitutional restraints in Germany. The interesting thing, though, was that the Weimar Constitution was never actually eliminated. It was in force for the entire period of the Third Reich. And as a matter of fact, it still held sway in everything except for political affairs. That was under the control of the party and the leader, Hitler. But if you were an embezzler in Germany, you had all the protections of the Weimar Constitution. As we move through time in Germany, the determination had been made to wage war for the projection of German power. And on November 5th, 1937, Hitler and his top people had a meeting in which it was outlined what was going to happen ahead. And basically it said that they were going to build up the military strength of Germany to expand its national interest and its economic interests in Europe. And if you look at the actual wording of the document, it has a very strange similarity to the PNAC Manifesto of 1999, in which the proponents of this said that the United States must be prepared to fight simultaneous wars to support American economic and security interests around the world. In the case of Hitler, it was only in Europe. In the case of PNAC, it was all around the world. The regime of the Nazis rewarded the economic elite. Industrialists, they never had it so good. German generals were rewarded with estates and bribes. Not bribes, but just extra payments for what they could do. The average German, especially working class, they saw their incomes actually decline through the 30s. Of course, they did have jobs, which was important. They previously did not have jobs, a lot of them, but now they had jobs, but their incomes were greatly reduced. And business in Germany was very good. As a matter of fact, even after the war started, business in Europe went under German control, certainly during the years that they were winning, was good. I remember one time that I picked up a copy of the New York Times for December 8th, 1941, after Pearl Harbor, because they had them that they printed that you could buy and look at them just to see what things were like. And way back on page 56 or someplace, there was a little article about the previous Friday there had been a meeting in Berlin of the heads of all of the European stock exchanges. And they were in a happy mood because the stocks in Europe were now at an all-time high since 1929. So business was good under the Nazis. Of course, up until they began to lose the war, then business became terrible. Fascism during that period in the 30s and the 40s was an ascendant political concept that was repeated in a lot of places. Most of Europe actually became fascist states. Spain, of course, under Franco, Portugal under Salazar, Poland, Romania, Hungary, not to mention Estonia, Latvia, Croatia, fascist countries all following the same model. Once the war was over, and of course it was a war against fascism, it became a concept and a word that was pushed off, you know, into the background because nobody wanted to be called a fascist anymore. But nevertheless, there were regimes post-war. Greece from 1967 to 72 under the Greek colonels. Chile under Pinochet. Indonesia under Suharto. Many regimes in Latin America, Honduras, Guatemala, Argentina, Brazil, at different points in time had regimes that you could classify as fascist or neo-fascist. And unfortunately, virtually all of them were backed by the United States, not something that we should be proud of. But in the equation of the Cold War, it was viewed that if you were anti-communist, that was good enough. Once again, the regimes were all characterized by the fact that the elite few prospered enormously, the masses did extremely poorly. And also, they were all hopelessly corrupt. One of the main concepts that I think we have to get into just a little bit is the idea of nationalism and patriotism and how they weave their way into this whole concept of what fascism is and what it isn't and what it shouldn't be. Nationalism is defined, again, the dictionary, an attitude, feeling, or belief characterized by a sense of national consciousness, an exaltation of one nation above all others, and an emphasis on loyalty to the promotion of the culture and interests of one nation as opposed to others and international groups. And that certainly isn't a good description of what a country should be. Unfortunately, that is the characteristic that is true of all fascist countries. Patriotism, on the other hand, is a very simple concept. It's love for or devotion to a country. Mark Twain said, "The only rational patriotism is loyalty to the nation all the time, loyalty to the government only when it deserves it." The fascist way was to equate the nation to the leader and or the government. Now, one interesting quote that I can throw in here that I think relates to nationalism as expressed so often here in the United States is, first of all, it's opposed to international groups. The UN is not going to tell us what we can or can't do. So interesting quote from Bush shortly before the invasion of Iraq was, "The United States does not need a permission slip from the UN to act in our national interest." And of course, we proceeded with that attack, even though it is in opposition to Article 21 of the UN, and Kofi Annan actually said that the invasion of Iraq was illegal. Fascism is always strong on symbolisms and slogans. A fascist regime is always filled with flags and bunting and paraphernalia to show support for the regime. An interesting little side point on that is the issue of lapel pins. If you look at pictures of diplomats in pre-war Europe, the interesting thing you can see, the diplomats from a democratic country don't have any pins. The diplomats from Germany and Italy inevitably had their swastikas or their axe and rods. Fast forward to today, we see throughout the world, there's only one country whose diplomats always have a flag in their lapels, and that's the United States. Small point, you have to ask yourself why, including the President of the United States, as if he didn't have that, we wouldn't know if he's a patriot or not, or who he was for or against. And even Mr. Obama has been hijacked into having to wear that pin every day. Again, symbolisms, contempt, you know, for international groups. Pre-war, it was the League of Nations, which was totally rejected by the fascists. Now it is the UN who is pushed down. Support for the national culture and traditions. A description of the support for the culture, for instance. This included the promotion of the exclusive use of the national language, public association with the prominent religion, suspicion of foreigners, suspicion of immigrants, and restrictions on their activities. These were typical of fascist regimes. In addition to promotion of the belief in a heroic and often false national past. Then we had a case of Lynn Cheney, who, as head of the National Endowment for the Humanities, insisted that the Department of Education destroy 300,000 copies of guidelines for American history textbooks. She contended that the guidelines did not offer a sufficiently polished and blemish-free rendition of American history. Apparently, according to Cheney, there was no need to learn from past errors or even admit to any. Slogans. We've heard a lot of them lately, and of course they had them back in the days of pre-war fascism as well. Blitzkrieg back then, shock and awe now. One nation, one leader, one people. That was the slogan in Germany. Now it's United We Stand. Drag nach Osten was the right to advance to the east. Axis of evil. Strike first. Smoking gun, you know, versus the mushroom cloud. Fight them there versus here. All these slogans that we hear. Doctrine of preemption. What was said by Bush prior to the invasion of Iraq versus what was said by Hitler prior to the invasion of Poland, Norway, Yugoslavia, and Russia? And it's unfortunate to say or to think that the words used are almost identical. Very scary. Hitler, before he attacked Poland, there is no willingness on the part of the Polish government to conduct negotiations, which was completely false because the Poles were doing everything they could to avoid the attack and wanted to talk about whatever the issues were. And Hitler is quoted as saying he would hate to see some Schweinhund who interrupted this chance to test out his Wehrmacht. Before the invasion of Iraq, Bush said, the Iraqi government has refused to allow inspectors free access to facilities. But according to Hans Blix, who was the lead inspector by the UN, they had cooperated completely and, in fact, were being proactive in showing more than was being asked. Obviously, the Iraqis didn't want to be invaded. Before the invasion of Norway, Hitler said, this invasion is necessary to prevent enemy use of Norwegian ports as staging areas for an attack on Germany. Actually, that was somewhat true. The British were thinking about that, and he knew it. Before the invasion of Iraq, Bush said, we are convinced that there is a grave danger that Iraq will supply weapons to terrorists who will use them to attack America. Before the invasion of Yugoslavia, Hitler said, we cannot trust the Yugoslavians to not interfere with our future plans. They must be crushed. Bush said, Saddam Hussein cannot be trusted to keep his word. It's almost exactly the same thing. We need to act. In advance of the invasion of Russia, Hitler stated, we must cut the noose before it can be drawn tight, which is very much like we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Now, I'm not saying, certainly not saying, that there is an equivalency between the U.S. and Germany in World War II. I'm not saying that. What is happening is that the words to justify these attacks are the same in both cases. And that just simply is not worthy of the United States of America. What the future may hold. Did the failure of the Bush presidency mean a tendency towards fascism is gone? Well, we certainly hope so. Polls showed that towards the end of his presidency, what were the reasons for his low approvals? One, handling of the economy, which jumped right up there this past fall because of what happened. Two, Iraq. Not necessarily the invasion of it, but the fact that it was bungled so badly. Three, Katrina. Four, general incompetence. Almost absent from the list, violating international law, abuse of the Constitution, abuse of power. And of course, the pledge that the president takes, the one thing he has to say is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Yet, conclusion, the Constitution not viewed important compared to other issues. So all these tendencies in a fascist direction that we've seen over these years didn't seem to make a big impression. And disappointedly, even with Obama in the White House, there doesn't seem to be a great impetus to look back on what we've just been through and to try to learn and to try to prevent these things from becoming a fact in the future. So, the question is, given this recent experience and the historic precedent that fascism comes about as a reaction to traumatic influence, consider the following. A major economic collapse, which we may well be in one right now. We have no idea how this is going to play out. We don't know what 3 years from now will be, whether we're going to be in a big depression, which will by that time will become the Obama depression. A terrorist act, such as nuclear, much, much worse than 9/11, or a major international oil shortage, which we kind of brush off now because prices are down, but as you all know, they can go way up real fast. And if a future political leader may well demand extraordinary power to deal with these crises, think if there is a leader who is charismatic instead of Bush. In fact, just think back if the situation had been that Bush was charismatic and he had sent in 500,000 men instead of 150,000 in Iraq and the attack had been successful, everyone would be ecstatic about what had happened. And the issues with the Constitution would be ignored. So if one of these events should happen in the future and there'd be some new Patriot Act, even more egregious than the one we've had, much more, and there was a recommendation to blame these others for our problems, what would our reaction be? What would happen? A gentleman by the name of Robert Paxton, who was an academic at Columbia, who was probably one of the world's great experts on fascism, he wrote, "The language and symbols of authentic American fascism would be familiar. No swastikas, but stars and stripes and Christian crosses. No fascist salutes, but mass recitation of the Pledge of Allegiance. Those symbols contain no hint of fascism, but would transform them into obligatory rituals for detecting the internal enemy. Huey Long once famously said, "When fascism comes to America, it will come wrapped in the American flag." And I want to close by saying that I am not anti-American by any means. I love my country, but I see that certainly in the last 8 years there's been this tremendous gap between what America could be and what America should be and what it is. And I think it's our job to point that out. And the hope of the future is that the majority of the people will recognize these issues and be on guard against them. But the jury's out, so I don't know how this will play out into the future.
Author and civil libertarian Larry Britt, speaking in Rochester, New York last month. Thanks to unwelcome guests, Rochester correspondent Carl Pultz of Alembic Productions for that recording. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Our next two speakers come to us courtesy of No Lies Radio, a new online radio station based in the San Francisco Bay Area. Dr. Kevin Barrett is the host of a new program on the station called Fair and Balanced. Barrett is co-founder of the Muslim Christian Jewish Alliance for 9/11 Truth, and he's taught English, French, Arabic, American civilization, humanities, African literature, folklore, and Islam at colleges and universities in the San Francisco Bay Area, Paris, and Madison, Wisconsin. He's the author of Truth Jihad, My Epic Struggle Against the 9/11 Big Lie, and he's the editor of 9/11 and the American Empire, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out. He became interested in the topic after reading The New Pearl Harbor by Professor David Ray Griffin, who he interviews in the next segment. Here's Kevin Barrett.
Well, today my guest is probably the most important person who has been dealing with a topic too hot for the mainstream during the past 7 years. That is Dr. David Ray Griffin, the author of The New Pearl Harbor, the seminal 9/11 truth book that asks the tough questions about what really happened on 9/11. His most recent published book is The New Pearl Harbor Revisited, which covers the territory of what's happened since 9/11 and what new evidence has turned up. He's also the author of the 9/11 Commission report, Omissions and Distortions, Debunking 9/11, Debunking 9/11 Contradictions, Christian Faith and the Truth Behind 9/11, and he's the editor of 9/11 and American Empire, Volume 1. He's also published a lot of articles, given a lot of talks, and has been really putting it on the line for this most important of contemporary political and cultural issues. So it's a great honor to welcome on the very first ever issue of Fair and Balanced, Dr. David Ray Griffin. Welcome, David. How are you doing? So where to start? You know, I guess last time we talked back in November, I believe it was, we had kind of a recap on what's happening with the 9/11 truth movement. Maybe you could give us another recap covering the last few months as well, and also tell us what are the directions of your current interests.
Well, there have been some very interesting developments in just the last few months that have further increased the credibility of the movement, and it's definitely time for people who wrote off questions about 9/11 long ago and you know, learned to roll their eyes when anybody questioned the official story. It's really time for a second look, because most people who still you know, do roll their eyes, form their view of the 9/11 movement, the 9/11 truth movement, as it's been called, back in the days when, you know, they could dismiss it as a bunch of kids on the internet, a bunch of weird conspiracy theorists. And to the extent that that was ever true, which was a small extent, but to the extent that it was ever true, it's certainly absolutely not true now. We have so many organizations of professionals. You know, originally we got Scholars for 9/11 Truth started, and then Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. And then that expanded to Veterans for 9/11 Truth. So we have lots of former military officers. And then Pilots for 9/11 Truth. And, you know, most people don't regard military officers and pilots as a bunch of kooks, but as rather solid people who know something about what's going on in the world. Well, that has continued to grow the number of professional organizations. So just a couple months ago, Lawyers for 9/11 Truth went up, and, you know, people can find these by just Googling. And now this... this last week, a new organization called Religious Leaders for 9/11 Truth just went live, and I believe we've only been up for about a week, and we've got 45 signers already, some of them very major figures in the religious world. And very soon, there's going to be medical professionals for 9/11 Truth. That one's probably going to go live this next week. And then following right on that will be political leaders for 9/11 Truth. So, and I didn't mention about the same time, a little before Lawyers went up, Firefighters for 9/11 Truth. And so... what you can say now is of people who are independent, meaning independent of a government salary, and who have really looked at the evidence and have some professional expertise that gives them some competence in dealing with these matters, all of these people now, the majority opinion, the overwhelming majority of such people reject the official story and either endorse or strongly suspect that the view that 9/11 was an inside job perpetrated by, as you've called them, perpetrators within our own government.
Well, that's fantastic, and it's really interesting, isn't it, that there are so many professional organizations of people like firefighters and pilots and, you know, military intelligence professionals and on and on and on, and we don't have the counterpart on the other side. That is that there's no firefighters against 9/11 Truth, pilots against 9/11 Truth, military leaders against 9/11 Truth. And I think the reason for that is, of course, you know, there are a lot of people in those groups who don't side with us, but those are people who haven't looked into it. And if you look at the so-called debunkers and the people who post on these allegedly, fair and balanced debunking websites, none of them seem to have both have a lot of credentials and are willing to allow themselves to be named. You know, we have all these anonymous people, a few of whom claim to have credentials, but how can you check? So it's really interesting that we have so many real people with credentials on our side, and they have hardly any on theirs.
Well, that's right. And, you know, if most people still get most of their news from the mainstream media, and if the mainstream media would let these people on, you know, former CIA, senior CIA officials, people who were pilots for 35 years and know all about interceptions and know what planes can do and can't do, and firefighters, some of whom were there that day and heard the explosions and would be willing to go on national TV and say they heard these explosions, if all of these people, and then the scientists, that, you know, we've got physicists and chemists who have done extraordinary studies now of the World Trade Center dust, and this simply is case closed if people will look at this evidence and understand it, because you have the signature, the chemical signature of nanothermite, sometimes called superthermite, and there's simply no way to explain how these extraordinary levels of all of these elements, you know, the iron, the sulfur, the aluminum, and other things that go into making this incendiary that at the nano level becomes a high explosive, extremely powerful, far more powerful than ordinary thermite or thermite, that, you know, scientists have independently found this in four different samples that were independently gathered of World Trade Center dust. And so the level of proof now, and these are being published. At one time, people were saying, well, you know, if there are anything to these theories, you could get these accepted in scientific journals. Well, in the first place, that's not as easy as one thinks. Scientific journals tend to be ideological, as you know, like other things are.
Well, they're worried about funding.
They do. Some of them do have to worry about funding, and also there's a fairly strong orthodoxy in some of the scientists. But nevertheless, already three major papers that Stephen Jones and physicist Stephen Jones and chemist Kevin Ryan and their colleagues have been co-authors of have been published in peer-reviewed journals. So the evidence is clear and has been convincing enough to the very skeptical and careful editors of these journals to allow these papers to be published.
And that is wonderful news. And Kevin Ryan, who's been the co-author of some of these papers, has done wonderful work in detective work, ferreting out the connections between some of the cover-up commissars at FEMA and NIST and the top-secret military work, well, not quite top-secret because he found out about it, concerning the development of these highly powerful nanothermites. It's very interesting they put these people who happen to be involved in advanced nanothermite research in charge of the 9/11 investigation, or rather the World Trade Center investigation.
Yes, I've been working a lot on this issue because the current book I'm working on is called The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why NIST's Final 9/11 Report is Unscientific and False. NIST, of course, is the National Institute of Science and Technology, of Standards and Technology. And it is an agency of the Commerce Department. And so I, of course, have been very interested to see who might become the next Secretary of Commerce. President Obama has promised that science is going to count in his new administration, and he has shown this with many of his appointments. But thus far, he hasn't evidently understood the importance of getting somebody in charge of commerce who has respect for scientific method, and he may be completely unaware that if you're going to talk about which government agency has distorted science for political purposes more than any other, I can't imagine that anyone would have distorted it to the extent that NIST has in its report on the World Trade Center towers, which came out in 2005, and then its report on World Trade Center 7, which came out just before the Bush administration was going to leave office.